Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Issues in 30 days. Let others talk only about the horse race. We've got 30 issues in 30 shows between now and the election. This week, a full week on inequality in America, beginning right now with issue 11 in our 30 issues series, what to do about all those Americans still facing foreclosure or whose homes are underwater. You know, the housing bubble reached its peak in early 2006 and gradually began to deflate. By 2010, foreclosure notices were sent to one out of every 45 homeowners in the United States. Last year, about 800,000 homes were repossessed, much higher than the historical average. In August, one in every 681 housing units in America was foreclosed on. That's just in one month. But the first Obama action to ease the foreclosure crisis also caused a backlash that helped to launch the Tea Party. Remember that? This TV clip that we're about to play is often credited with being the first Tea Party moment. It's CNBC commentator Rick Santelli ranting to an audience at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange in Chicago in 2009.
You know, the government is promoting bad behavior because we certainly don't want to put stimulus forth and give people a whopping $8 or $10 in their check and think that they ought to save it. And in terms of modifications, I'll tell you what, I have an idea. You know, the new administration's big on computers and technology. How about this, president and new administration? Why don't you put up a website to have people vote on the internet as a referendum to see if we really want to subsidize the losers' mortgages? Or would we like to at least buy cars and buy houses in foreclosure and give them to people that might have a chance to actually prosper down the road and reward people that could carry the water instead of drink the water?
Hey, Rick,
that's a novel idea.
Hey, Rick, did you?
What? Who thought of that?
They're like putty in your hands. Did you hear?
No, they're not, Joe. They're not like putty in our hands. This is America. How many of you people want to pay for your neighbor's mortgage that has an extra bathroom and can't pay their bills? Raise their hand.
How about we all?
President Obama, are you listening?
Rick Santelli and fans at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange on CNBC in 2009, a moment that launched the Tea Party movement. Our first guest in our week on inequality is Yale economist Robert Shiller, co-founder of the Case-Shiller Housing Index, which measures home prices. He's the author of books including Finance and the Good Society, recently published by the Princeton University Press. Dr. Shiller, thanks so much for coming on. Welcome to WNYC.
Hi, Brian.
I'll get your thoughts in a little while on the Santelli rant and whether we were subsidizing the losers' mortgages and helping people who are irresponsible enough to buy extra bathrooms that they couldn't afford. But you have argued that rising inequality in the U.S. was a major cause of the housing crisis. That's fascinating. What kinds of inequality?
Well, we have two kinds of inequality. One of them that attracts the most attention lately is the 1%. The top 1% of our incomes has been growing rapidly. This is what motivates Occupy Wall Street. They've said, we are the 99%. But there's another kind of inequality that I think is actually more serious. This is the inequality that afflicts people in the bottom half of the income distribution. Their incomes are stagnating and in many cases falling. I think that's a more serious problem. I mean, some people can be super rich, and it really, if it's only 1% of the population, it doesn't affect us that much. But it's the people who are having trouble making ends meet, who can't find any job, that are the real concern.
Did the bubble mask inequality for a period of time because so many people saw their home values going up?
Right. This is a theme that was particularly advanced by Raghuram Rajan, who's a University of Chicago professor, in his recent book a couple of years ago called Fault Lines. He had a chapter in that book called Let Them Eat Credit, which is a throwback to Marie Antoinette, who is supposedly said, let them eat cake when referring to the starving multitudes, and it was taken as a sign of her insensitivity. Well, we've moved past the Maria Antoinette days, and we're in a period now where governments may, during a period of dissatisfaction, they may indulge in giving credit, encouraging credit for the poor so they can buy houses. And this is what Rajan accuses the Bush administration of encouraging. I don't know how much it was the Bush administration, but this national policy in general.
Maybe Bush and Clinton and the federal housing policy under both those presidents. Is it fair to say it was designed to reduce inequality by making it easier for more people with lower incomes to buy homes rather than rent?
Well, I don't know if that was their stated policy, but that was certainly the effect. And the idea was they wanted to keep people believing that they were part of this American dream, even if it was over. And so that is what they did. And the problem is, see, we have a system in which there's a new election every 4 years, and a president can't run be president for more than eight. So maybe he doesn't worry so much about the long-run consequences, right? He's trying to get reelected, and will then stimulate the economy without much concern for the long term.
And so do you think, in retrospect, that that policy was misguided? I mean, lower-income people and their advocates had been lobbying specifically for more access to credit in our credit-fueled country.
Well, I know. In fact, I remember there was a New York Times, I think it was the Times or the Journal, by Martin Luther King III, who in the 1990s said that it's an outrage that credit is more freely available to whites than blacks. And he made veiled references to the housing boom. Well, it wasn't such a boom back then, but the idea was that investments benefit the class that gets them, a housing investment. So there was almost like you, in order to be a good person, you had to support a lot of credit for low-income people. And I think these people were well-meaning. I mean, I wouldn't have objected to, you know, it is important that everyone be brought in to feel part of this country. And, I don't think that I would stress it as much as Raghuram Rajan did. I think that these policies may have contributed to the bubble, but they were, I think, well-meaning policies. And the real bubble really was caused more broadly. It wasn't attributed well to government low-income stimulus policy.
So in terms of what to do about it, that Rick Santelli Tea Party rant suggested to his stockbroker audience at the Chicago Merc that foreclosure relief would mean they would bail out their greedy neighbors, a new kind of undeserving poor, I guess, because they splurged on an extra bathroom that they couldn't afford. How much does that describe the Americans who have actually been foreclosed upon, as far as you know?
Oh, well, that's a good question. I don't think that's true at all, but I don't have the statistics at hand. Paul Willen and Christopher Foote at the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston have written about this, and my general impression from what they've said is that it's really not that kind of phenomenon as much as you'd think. Actually, lenders were fairly good at informing people, keeping them informed, and I think they were well-meaning, hard as that might sound, in most of the cases. They're accused of taking, let's say, often people who recently immigrated and don't even speak English very well, and giving them loans that didn't serve their interests well. For example, they gave them a lot of adjustable rate mortgages whose payments could have shot up when interest rates went up. But see, it wasn't as bad as that seemed because the interest rates didn't go up. And so I think it was more of a general phenomenon. Let's not play. We call it the subprime crisis, but it wasn't just subprime. It was the broader market. The bubble goes, by the way, even into commercial real estate. Into all four categories, there's residential, warehouse, office, and retail. They all went through a bubble. And in fact, it wasn't just the United States. It was many countries of the world. So I think it was a social, my view of it, and not social phenomenon, and not particularly caused by policy toward low-income borrowers.
Robert Shiller, my guest on WNYC, the first guest in our week of conversations about inequality in our 30 Issues in 30 Days election series. Robert Shiller, the developer, among other things, co-developer of the Case-Shiller Housing Index, which you hear cited on the news all the time, and author of the recent book Finance and the Good Society. On the rising inequality in the U.S., more generally, you've said that it's believed to be from a skills gap, that rapid technological change in recent decades greatly favors the highly educated more than the economy used to. We've all heard this. But you think the data does not support that as the chief cause of inequality. What do you think the data does show?
Well, I think at that point I was talking about the top 1%. And shocking increase in the top 1% incomes doesn't seem to be – it's not a question of the story that people tell, which I think does have some validity about low-income the loss of low-income incomes is that it was caused by machines replacing jobs. I think there has to be some element of truth to that. But it doesn't explain the rapid rise of incomes at the top tier, at the top 1%. And that's an interesting phenomenon. I don't know that we understand that one either. There are people who write books about this who argue that the top 1% increase has to do with political imbalances. That I'm thinking of a book called Winner Take All Politics by Hacker and Pearson. It came out a year or so ago. They show evidence that lobbying on behalf of financial interests, big time, you know, bank lobbyists, have gotten more powerful. And at the same time, the groups that used to lobby on behalf of the common person, like labor unions, have gotten weaker. So that right now, anything that the government does that threatens the interest of the big financial corporations is attacked. And these people have also the ability to get in and analyze the details of the regulations and tweak them to their own special interest in ways that the public wouldn't understand unless they spent, you know, months studying the issues. So this is a problem that we have now. But there is, in addition, I think in the long run, also a problem of what they used to call technological unemployment, that we are replacing jobs with computers now. They're both at work.
We have a couple of callers waiting on the line who want to push back against some of the things that you've said. So let's hear from one or two folks. Sam in Montclair, you're on WNYC. Hello, Sam.
Yes, good morning, Brian. My question to Mr. Shiller, I believe that he's part of this corrupt system that packaged these mortgages knowingly and sold it as AAA rated stuff that got the whole economy down. How can he be so naive right now to say that only a small percent of these mortgages were fraudulent, when in fact 95% of these mortgages were fraudulent? It was a boiler room operation, and Wall Street needed volume. And they had all these unsuspected homeowners with a meager saving of $25,000, $10,000 down. They made a deposit on these homes, and then they lost that too along with their homes. So how can he now come along and say and support his Wall Street buddies for pulling out this most heinous of financial crime?
Dr. Shiller.
Well, I'm sorry to have upset Sam. I don't there were things that, incidentally, you may think morally that there were crimes, but they weren't legally crimes. These people know how to stay within the law. And so what were the crimes? One of them is that the mortgage documentation wasn't being pursued properly. I guess that's well known. I don't know if that was a criminal act, but it was an act that brought some criticism onto the mortgage industry. Another thing that your caller refers to is that mortgage rating agencies have made the mistake of giving AAA ratings to some mortgage securities that later defaulted. I do have a connection to Standard & Poor's. I don't make any money from them, but I work with them to produce the S&P Case-Shiller indices. So they're my friends, I suppose, and I feel maybe some bias because of that. I think that was, however, a serious mistake. that it may have reflected some errors in self-interested errors in judgment
by the ratings agencies.
But again, it's not criminal. They didn't break any laws, and they have promised to clean that act up now. And I think it's okay. I also say I know these people, and it doesn't strike me as evil. It sounds to me more like a failure of judgment. And
well, what might be seen as evil, if not criminal, is if a lot of people who any good bank representative should have known were not qualified for a particular loan or a particular size loan, but were given them anyway because the bank knew that they could sell the mortgage off quickly into mortgage securitization and not take any of the risk on the client, who they may have been quietly, secretly saying, oh, that guy's going to default in a year, but it's not our problem. Maybe that's evil. Maybe that's criminal.
Yeah, I think that, in my new book, Finance and the Good Society, I try to make it very clear that the book is not defending everything people do in this system at all. But in my book, arguing that the system is basically good and we ought to improve it. I'm not saying that there aren't people of criminal inclination. Of course there are, and there always will be. But we do live in a nation of laws, and we have to think about what kind of laws we want to make. Now, the Dodd-Frank Act tightens the laws on mortgage lenders. It makes them more responsible and more vulnerable to penalty. Another thing that happened back then, before the crisis, we didn't have licensing for mortgage brokers, and now many states have introduced licensing for them. So we've tightened up again. It used to be that you could walk right out of jail as an ex-con and then start a practice as a mortgage broker, because there was no restrictions against that. So we've tightened that up. So I think definitely there were people who were selfish, who didn't care, and who used this financial system to their own advantage. I don't think that was the primary cause of this crisis, because the crisis is much broader than that. But I think that the Dodd-Frank legislation was an excellent piece of legislation. It's a start toward reforming our financial markets, and that's where we should go next.
Let me take one more caller, pushing back from another political perspective, I think a different political perspective than the previous caller. Mike in Jersey City, you're on the air. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, hi there, Brian. It's an honor to speak to you, Dr. Schiller. I would have to question, quite frankly, the minimization of the decision to basically a government policy involving subprime mortgages. It basically said, we're going to lend money to people, and we're going to have semi-government agencies subsidize lending to people, whether they can afford houses or not. I really think you minimize that as a factor in the general inflation of real estate. But the real question I wanted to ask you is this, and it has to do with the language both you and Brian have been using, which is it would be easy to forget that all the people that borrowed all this money and bought all this real estate were, in fact, adults. This wasn't a bunch of nine-year-olds. This was adults, okay? And the notion that adults don't know how to count and don't know how to figure out whether they can afford a mortgage payment or do a household budget, I would suggest is the real core of not only the problem, but the policy solutions that assume that people who are adults should not have to accept the consequences of bad decisions they make as adults.
But what about Mike, what's your response to a story like this that a cab driver told me the other week? He hardly makes any money. You know, he said he was making like $12,000 a year in 2004 when he accompanied his mother to get a home loan for something that she was buying. And the bank tried to sell him on a very bulky mortgage, saying that he could afford a tremendous amount of mortgage debt. that he didn't actually believe that he could afford. So he was in your category of people who were grown-ups who could do the math, and he declined this mortgage. But for many other people, if the bank is saying, oh, you can afford this, you're qualified for this, then do we put the sole responsibility on the individual?
Well, no. There's two sets of issues here. A, okay, you can't simultaneously tell everybody that banks are filled with evil, voracious, immoral people and then say, but the bank told me, and that makes it okay, all right, that they're somehow more credible than the guy who stands outside the hospital and tells me he needs bus fare, okay? On the other hand, who cares? I mean, obviously we should care when any business person engages, or any person, period, engages in unethical behavior. But the fact is, you're an adult. You run into people like this all the time in all aspects of life, unless you live in a nicer world than I live in, okay? I mean, the old phrase was caveat emptor.
And Mike, forgive me, I'm gonna end it there because our time is getting very tight, but I'm going to get a response for you from Dr. Schiller. Briefly on this, Dr. Schiller. But this is the Rick Santelli argument.
Right. We do. People deserve to be treated as adults, and they can make their own mistakes. I think, though, that there's so much to say here. I think that one problem that comes up here is that people feel that they've been deceived or manipulated by salespeople. Dodd-Frank reacted to that by creating a Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which it's going to review sales tactics. People are sometimes, even if you're an intelligent adult, you don't appreciate being victimized by someone who is going after you. In my book, Finance and the Good Society, I said, I think that we have too many salespeople in our society and that we should get more financial advisors who are loyal to their client. This is where we should go. And I think that we should subsidize them, actually, just as we subsidize medical advice. We have Medicare and Medicaid. People need financial advice, and they can make them an intelligent adults are being victimized, and we have to improve the financial system to reduce that.
And is that one of the steps that you think society needs to take to reduce inequality, since you say that the housing bubble was caused by inequality and inequality is getting worse? Take our last minute and talk about what your larger agenda would be for reducing inequality in America.
Yeah, well, this is something I talk a lot about in my book. A very unequal society seems absurd. We shouldn't. It's not the good society. So there's many steps that can be taken, and even Dodd-Frank has already begun to take some of them. But the other things are that I think that we need a tax system. This is politically difficult, but we need a tax system that is more aggressive at high incomes. And we need protections for individuals, like home value insurance or livelihood insurance that I talk about in the book, that would insulate people from, I suppose we need better financial education. There's so many different steps. Inequality is a difficult thing to deal with. But on top of that, I should say at the end, we don't want to equalize incomes either. We want there to be a incentive for some people to work hard. And if someone spends their whole life working 12 hours a day, you might say, that's being a workaholic. Maybe, maybe not, but we don't want to take away the fruits of their labor. There's that aspect of inequality, too.
Yeah.
It's partly in America that we respect that some people work harder and achieve more than others, and we think they deserve to keep at least a good share of that.
Yale economist Robert Schiller, co-founder of the Case-Shiller Housing Index, which measures home prices. He is the author of Finance and the Good Society, recently published by the Princeton University Press. Thank you, Dr. Schiller.
Brian, it's a pleasure.
Now, after the break, we will bring on Robin Farzad from Business Week to continue this conversation and compare Romney's and Obama's approaches to the foreclosure crisis. And listeners, do you have policies that you favor for dealing with that? 212-433-WNYC, issue 11 in our 30 Issues in 30 Days election series. the victims of 2008, what to do about the ongoing foreclosure crisis, 212-433-9692. And in a minute, we'll hear in their own words how different Romney and Obama are on this. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with 30 issues in 30 days. Let others talk only about the horse race. We've got 30 issues to discuss in 30 shows between now and the election. This week, a full week on inequality in America, beginning today with issue 11 in our 30-issue series, what to do about all those Americans who are still underwater with their mortgages or facing foreclosure. And check this out. We have a 30 issues foreclosure timeline map from Realty Track that you can play for today's topic. Go to WNYC.org/issues and watch this map change for every county in the United States from 2007 to the present at WNYC.org/issues. Now we'll compare the Romney and Obama positions on what to do about homeowners who are underwater or in foreclosure. And let's jump right in with the soundbite that has generated the most attention on this issue. It's Mitt Romney with something that he has said multiple times. This version is from a recorded interview with the Las Vegas Review-Journal editorial board. The idea here is basically that we do nothing to slow the foreclosure rate.
As to what to do for the housing industry specifically, and are there things that you can do that to encourage housing? One is don't try and stop the foreclosure process. Let it run its course and hit the bottom, allow investors to buy homes, put renters in them, fix the homes up, and let it turn around and come back up. The Obama administration has slow-walked the foreclosure processes that have long existed, and as a result, we still have a foreclosure overhang. Number two, the credit that was given to first-time homebuyers was insufficient and inadequate to turn around the housing market. I think it was an ineffective idea. It was a little bit like the Cash for Clunkers program, throwing government money at something which was not market-oriented, did not staunch the decline in home values any more than it encouraged the auto industry to take off. I think the idea of helping people refinance homes to stay in them is one that's worth further consideration. But I'm not signing on until I find out who's going to pay, and who's going to get bailed out, and that's not something which we know all the answers to yet.
So that was Mitt Romney from just about a year ago, October 2011, in Las Vegas. But what happened in Las Vegas did not stay in Las Vegas, and Democrats have been very critical of that position. Here is President Obama in February of this year referring to Romney's position as he urges Congress to pass his latest foreclosure relief bill.
The housing crisis has been the single biggest drag on a recovery from the recession. It's kept millions of families in debt and unable to spend, and it has left hundreds of thousands of construction workers out of a job. But there's something even more important at stake. I've been saying this is a make-or-break moment for the middle class. And the housing crisis struck right at the heart of what it means to be middle class in this country. Owning a home, raising our kids, building our dreams. Right now, there are more than 10 million homeowners in this country who, because of a decline in home prices that is no fault of their own, owe more on their mortgages than their homes are worth. It's wrong for anyone to suggest that the only option for struggling responsible homeowners is to sit and wait for the housing market to hit bottom. I don't accept that. None of us should. That's why we launched a plan a couple of years ago that's helped nearly 1 million responsible homeowners refinance their mortgages and save an average of $300 on their payments each month. I'll be the first to admit it didn't help as many folks as we had hoped, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't keep trying. And that's why I'm sending Congress a plan that will give every responsible homeowner the chance to save about $3,000 a year on their mortgages by refinancing at historically low rates. No more red tape, no more endless forms, and a small fee on the largest financial institutions will make sure it doesn't add a dime to the deficit. I want to be clear, this plan will not help folks who bought a house they couldn't afford and then walked away from it. It won't help folks who bought multiple houses just to turn around and sell them in speculation. What this plan will do is help millions of responsible homeowners who make their payments every month, but who until now couldn't refinance because their home values kept dropping or they got wrapped up in too much red tape.
Extended excerpts from President Obama and Governor Romney on how to address the foreclosure crisis. Let's get some more context now with Robin Farzad from Bloomberg Businessweek. Hi, Robin. Welcome back to WNYC.
Good morning, Brian. How are you?
Good. And let's begin with the president. I noticed that he used the term over and over again, responsible homeowners. And he even seemed to talk back to that Rick Santelli Tea Party CNBC rant that we played earlier in the show from 2009 about irresponsible homeowners buying an extra bathroom that they couldn't afford, and so foreclosure policy should not bail them out. Responsible homeowners. What exactly was the bill that the president was urging Congress to pass, and how does he distinguish between responsible homeowners who get into trouble and others?
Well, let's step back for a minute, and let's not forget that briefly after his inauguration in 2009, President Obama was pushing his signature program, which was the Home Affordable Modification Program, where we could effectively cut monthly payments to about a third of monthly income if you were also considered a responsible homeowner who was struggling, by reducing the interest rate, extending the term of the loan, temporary forbearance. A lot has since changed. For starters, this program, I mean, much the administration's own admission, has been a failure. About a million people have been kicked out of it while it's only helping something over 800,000 people. And interest rates have plummeted, one, because the economy has been in the tank, and two, because the Federal Reserve has been pushing down rates to historic lows. So right now, what you want to do is be able to get to sequester a slice of these 10 million Americans with negative equity in their homes and be able to say, you know what? Let's let you bring down that interest rate so you can avail yourself of these historically low rates. The problem with that is a couple of things. One, it's assuming that the banks are going to go out and let you go ahead on that refinancing. And two, when he's saying this is not adding a cent to the taxpayer burden, in fact, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are the only options to backstop home ownership finance in this country. And those are, in fact, taxpayer owned. So if Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are not out there backing mortgages, there's no way you're going to be able to have this refinancing boom that the administration envisions would cut the distressed homeowner rate.
So he's got this alphabet soup of foreclosure relief plans. We've had the HARP and the HAMP and the UP program, which is for unemployed people. There was the hardest hit program, as it was called, for communities with the highest concentrations of foreclosures. Is it fair to say that the Obama foreclosure relief effort in general has been pretty ineffective?
It I mean, you have seen a natural slowdown of certain pockets of foreclosure where it was really in free fall, and you had something as traumatic as the home ownership rate plummet from 69%, its all-time high, to 65%. That might not sound like all that much, but in fact, that entails the eviction of millions of Americans. And this has been a process that's been rife with all sorts of difficulties. You have a $25 billion settlement that was struck with a bunch of banks over their messiness in evicting people and how they were kind of turbo foreclosing on people. Anyway, step back from it all. Long and short is it's extremely hard to strip all that aside and say, here we go. Here is that responsible homeowner who's struggling, who has negative equity, who is indeed very eligible and should be given a 3.5% 30-year mortgage in 2012 with the government's blessing. That's where you get at the most vexingly difficult part of the equation.
And he gets criticism from the left, doesn't he, saying that he should have a program like this that requires the banks to participate rather than being voluntary for the banks and having to be backstopped by the government.
Well, you try to wrest the bone from the banks' mouths. I mean, they are in the process of recapitalizing themselves. The government, after all, and the Treasury Department has had multiple stress tests for the banks, and it has since passed most of them and said you are free to go off and lend again and do what you did in the past, albeit with a whole new set of rules. is the government really in any position to tell them to take a bigger haircut to what they thought their assessed value on these homes were? Because after all, you have to take a write down. And if you take a write down, you take a hit to capital, potentially have to go out and raise money again. And oh, by the way, the taxpayer still owns Citigroup, effectively. The taxpayer owns GMAC, now called Ally Financial. So you see, Brian, there's a kind of a circularity here where in the end, the taxpayer's on the hook for it anyway.
Listeners, we want your calls on what you think should be done about the ongoing foreclosure crisis and homeowners underwater. 212-433-WNYC. If you see yourself as one of these victims of the housing bubble, call us at 212-433-9692. Or if you think like Mitt Romney does, that there should be nothing that the government does and the market should be allowed to work its way out of the foreclosure crisis, regardless of how many people get kicked out of their homes practically, what should government do and what do you think of Obama's and Romney's competing positions? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. For Robin Farzad from Bloomberg Businessweek. And Robin, let's turn to Governor Romney. When he says, don't try to stop the foreclosure process, let it run its course and hit bottom, what's the theory behind that? Does he argue that it would help more people in the long run than by trying to keep some from avoiding foreclosure today?
I think he would argue that, but you have to see where this guy is coming from. He's a cold-eyed private equity person who's as experienced with distressed assets, with vulture investing, that he knows that when certain assets are in distress, the worst thing you can do is try to, prop up demand artificially for these assets, prop up the price artificially, because you're just postponing an inevitable reckoning. In this case, could we have taken a tremendous amount of pain, i.e. a depression-inducing amount of pain in 2008 and 2009, and evicted even multiples of the Americans that have been evicted, saw housing prices maybe fall, I don't know, about 50-60%, and then you have suddenly people who, in that presentation that he gave to that newspaper editorial board last year that you quoted, investors come in and shape up these homes and rent them out and get income out of that. That is something that an investor would indeed do. The only way you're going to see this market equilibrate is not to stick this huge wad of gum and paste at that nexus of the natural supply and demand curves. But obviously that is politically impossible to do in this country. You can certainly run against what the Obama administration has done, because that is the period that has seen foreclosures peak, unemployment jump. He can say that it's been kind of an incomplete progress report in the way of what the Home Affordable Modification Program has offered Americans ultimately, and vis-a-vis what was promised. But you also have to call out Romney and wonder if anybody could have stood up out there after kind of the inauguration and say, you know, much the same way. What was it? The newspaper cover that said Ford to New York dropped dead.
Right.
You can't really say that to homeowners. It would almost be like the evil banker in A Wonderful Life, you know, Mr. Potter. That's you know, not a good ingredient for your first 100 days in office.
I guess. Well, you know, Romney did say in that clip that the idea of helping people refinance their homes is worth looking at further, but it depends on who is paying and who is getting bailed out. Has he gotten specific on what kinds of refinancing programs he would or wouldn't support?
Not enough, because that is where, again, as before, it becomes so difficult to sequester who is eligible, who is worthy, and who is a speculator. It's very easy for him to spend, I think, 85% of that agenda on his website criticizing the Obama administration bullet after bullet after bullet, and then throwing out a couple or two or three platitudinous promises and saying that we need to look at private solutions. But he does hit on Fannie and Freddie, which is something that, I mean, the taxpayer has only dug himself deeper in that hole in terms of owning mortgage finance in this country. You would not be able to have anything on the order of a 3.4% or 3.5% 30-year mortgage if you didn't have these government-sponsored entities out there on the hook for the mortgages ultimately.
But I do wonder, how is his position different in the real world from Obama's? If in theory he's against trying to stop the foreclosure process, like the cold-eyed investor that he is, but he supports a refinancing plan, aren't the Obama program basically refinancing plans, or are they something else? And do we really have reason to believe that Romney would do something radically different if he were to be elected?
Yeah, I mean, somebody should put his hand to the fire and say, okay, what do you mean by refinancing? Is this just stretching out the terms of the loan, just making it easier for you in the near term while you are not exactly as well-employed as you were in the past, or you're dealing on a month-to-month basis? Or are we actually talking about cramming down principal reductions to the banks, which is something that I doubt if you kind of pushed him on that, he would say, yes, I am going to go up to Wells Fargo and Bank of America and JPMorgan Chase and tell them that you all need to take haircuts on this, lest we be stuck in this crisis for another 10 years. I think that's really where you'd see a difference in ideology and opinion and actionability among the two candidates.
Well, maybe Jim Lehrer will ask him that question in the domestic policy debate in Colorado on Wednesday night. We will see. We will take a short break and go to your calls and what you would like to see in foreclosure relief or underwater mortgage relief policy, if anything, from the federal government. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. As we continue with 30 issues in 30 days, issue 11, foreclosure and those underwater mortgages. Stay with us. And don't forget our 30 Issues Foreclosure Timeline Map, created by the amazing WNYC Data Graphics team. You can play this map for today's topic at WNYC.org/issues. Watch the map change for every county in the United States from 2007 to the present. Our interactive foreclosure timeline at WNYC.org/issues. We're comparing the Romney and Obama positions on foreclosures and underwater mortgages with Robin Farzad from Bloomberg Businessweek. And we'll go to your calls now, 212-433-WNYC. Lee in New Rochelle, you're on the air. Hi, Lee. Lee, are you there?
Seeing parts of my house right now trying to raise its value. I bought my house in 2006, and I had been shopping since 1998. I knew it was a bubble. I saw prices go up year after year after year. I kept looking, finally got a place. I did the responsible thing, you know, made sure I had a mortgage I could afford, a school system where my kids could go to school right through high school, big enough house. Still, I'm down probably about $125,000.
What would you like in terms of government policy? Anything?
Well, no, I just want to make a comment on the callers who are making comments about, or on the government officials who are making comments about how it's the homeowner's fault. I mean, I did everything right, but still I'm down. And, you know, save for the fact my wife and I have had secure jobs, you know, we could be in the same boat.
Right.
And I could be hearing government officials tell me how I was irresponsible.
Lee, thank you very much. David in Trenton, you're on WNYC. Hi, David.
Hi, Brian. Long time listener, first time caller.
Glad to hear
you. I just wanted to comment on the HAMP. I'm currently enrolled in the program, and while many say that the program was a failure, I have to say that I benefited from it. And I also wanted to say if we can help industry, help bail out the banks, the auto industry, government should do the same for its citizens.
Thank you. How is the HAMP helping you? Can you give us just like a 15-second description of how it works in your case?
Well, in short, it cut my interest rate, which in turn cut my payment, and I had fallen behind on the payment, and that payment still has to be paid. They just put it on the back of the loan.
David, thank you so much, and good luck to you. So, Robin Farzad, here's an example of the interest rate being cut, which cuts his monthly expense, which lets him stay in his home. And yet a lot of the activists are insistent that this is only going to work for a lot of people facing foreclosure if the principal is cut. And I think you referred to this before, not if the interest rate only is cut. What's the difference if it reduces the monthly payment either way?
Think about the ongoing long-term demoralization of owing more on your home than it's worth. Let's say, you know, you have a $300,000 mortgage and now your home is worth, you know, it fell from something on the order of $450,000 to $250,000. And you're thinking it's just a losing battle. I'm struggling to make ends meet, and I have to dutifully send this check to the bank every month because it's super stigmatized. If I become in arrears, I lose everything. My credit rating is scrapped, and it's going to take me 7 years to recover my credit worthiness. There's really a double standard in terms of what corporations in this country can do. A real estate investment trust can sometimes default strategically on bum, regrettable investments, but it's really stigmatized with homeowners. You're told that the only honorable thing to do is to service that debt, is to continue paying dutifully. You signed on the dotted line, and you knew what you got into, and you have effectively a moral obligation to keep doing that for whatever is left, 24, 25 years. So you can see how difficult it is, even with the HAMP program and the caller who just called in, to say to people, you know what, we are going to make your life easier for the next 3, 4, 5 years and push the majority of the principal and the pain out. This, in Romney's perspective, says that you're only just stretching out the pain. And do we really want to be dealing with the remnants of the 2008-2009 housing crisis in the year 2020? One candidate is out there saying, take the majority of the pain right now. The other one is implicitly saying, we can amortize the pain over a longer period. And frankly, let's hope that home values come back up and save all of us.
Sally in Leonia, you're on WNYC. Hi, Sally.
Hi, hello. I'm a big fan. I listen to your show every day.
Thank you.
I mean, I really think that I'm the poster child for the underrepresented citizen. I think the real conflict of interest today is in the appraisers who work for the banks. I've tried every government program. They won't give me a modification because I have too much money in savings. I've tried to refinance my home. They won't let me do that because I have too little money. And the appraisers that come out here appraise my home at 40% less than what I purchased this home for. Mm. Now, when I bought the home, the appraisers were in cahoots with the realtors, who are also, you know, I think part of the problem here. And they appraised the house for even more than what we got the mortgage for. And nobody wants to help me because I have the type of mortgage that's so-called toxic. And now I didn't know my mortgage was toxic, and now I can't do anything.
Is it a subprime mortgage?
No, I'm paying 7.25% in one of the Tony neighborhoods, suburbs of New York City, and they won't help me at all.
What would you
not
like?
At all.
What would you like from the government in terms of policy? Anything you can put your finger on?
Yes, I think there's a conflict of interest between the appraisers and the banks. And I think that needs to be looked into. I am not helped.
Sally, thank you very much for your call. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. We're almost out of time with Robin Farzad from Bloomberg Business Week. We thank everybody for your calls. We got a good couple of interesting stories in there of how the policy with respect to the foreclosure and underwater mortgage crisis is affecting people in our listening area in real life. And we just have 30 seconds left. Robin Farzad from Bloomberg Business Week. So what would you like to say?
Is yours no longer a PG-rated program? I was under the impression that this was a family show.
I know we had a caller who accidentally used one of those forbidden words, and you were able to hear it. But we used our famous dump button, and the listeners out there were protected. Their sensibilities were protected from this horrible fate of hearing one of those words on the list. So we leave it there with Robin Farzad, contributing editor to Bloomberg Business Week, at the conclusion of 30 Issues in 30 Days, Issue 11, Underwater Mortgages and Foreclosures. Robin, thanks a lot.
My pleasure. Take care.
And listeners, don't forget, we have a couple of ways you can follow up on this at WNYC.org/issues that are really interesting. We have our foreclosure timeline map from the amazing WNYC data graphics team. Watch the foreclosure rates change county by county from 2007 to the present at WNYC.org/issues, and read some of the articles that are related to this in our partnership with longform.org, all at WNYC.org/issues.